This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more details, see jodcast.net.
I'm at the Radboud University of Nijmegen, which is in the Netherlands. With me is Dr. Gijs Nelemans, who is from the Department of Astrophysics. Gijs, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
No problem, you're very welcome.
So I understand you know an awful lot about a proposed experiment called LISA. Can you explain to us what LISA is?
Yes, so LISA is a very ambitious project, but it's also a very exciting project because if it will materialize, which we'll all hope, it will be a really new way of studying the universe.
So what does LISA stand for?
Yeah, that's an abbreviation of Laser Interferometer Space Antenna, and LISA is a nice name. So LISA is an instrument to try to detect gravitational waves, and gravitational waves are waves emitted by stellar or supermassive objects in the universe because of the theory of general relativity as developed by Einstein. He predicts that if there are very massive, very compact objects, in particular if they are accelerated, and one of the ways to do that is to put them in a binary system, so two objects orbiting around each other, let's for the moment say two black holes to immediately make life very exciting, then they emit gravitational waves. And what it actually means is that the orbit of the two objects around each other is very slowly changed because the system loses some energy and angular momentum, and angular momentum is sort of a measure of how things go around each other, and this is lost in these gravitational waves. You can't see them, so you can't actually detect them with sort of the ordinary telescopes that people have with mirrors, or also not with telescopes that detect radio emission.
So telescopes that detect electromagnetic waves.
That's right. So it's not electromagnetic waves. It's actually something that's very difficult to imagine, because really, the way Einstein has described the universe, or basically the gravitational universe, is that gravity is properties of what's often called space-time, and you should imagine this as something like all the space we live in, and these gravitational waves are actually perturbations of the space itself, and this always sounds very weird, but basically you have to imagine something which is often said, imagine that space is a sheet of paper or a sheet for on the bed, and then these gravitational waves are ripples in this sheet. If you live on that sheet and somebody else also lives on that sheet, if a gravitational wave passes, something happens between the relative position of the two observers. And that's exactly the same how gravitational waves work in three-dimensional space. And that means that if you would have two observers, the distance between the two observers would gradually change when a gravitational wave passes.
So how can LISA observe these gravitational waves?
The way LISA observes the gravitational waves is using lasers. So the gravitational waves make small deviations in the distances between observers, or in the case of LISA, when LISA is a space mission, between the spacecraft. These are extremely small, these deviations in the distance. So LISA measures this by sending laser beams from one spacecraft to the other, but with these lasers they can measure the changes in the distance because the speed of light is constant. So if the distance becomes a little bit larger, it takes a little bit longer for the light to go there. And you have then to measure, to imagine that the distances that they have to measure, so the changes in the distance, are extremely small. So the spacecraft for LISA are expected to be, or the plan is to have them 5 million kilometers apart, so really far away, and still the change in the distance will only be of the order of the size of an atom.
So you have to observe something incredibly small over a huge distance.
That's right, that's right. So that's one of the problems of this whole project, is that it's very technically challenging to do. But the good thing is that actually similar experiments happen on Earth, and I'll explain in a moment why, what's the difference between doing it on Earth and in space. And these experiments on Earth, of course, don't have arms of 5 million kilometers, but only of 4 or 5 kilometers. But still they actually want to measure the same relative displacement of the mirrors in these experiments. So that means that they have to measure, the absolute measurement has to be a million times more accurate. So that's good for the LISA project, because it means that the techniques used to actually do the measurements are very well developed. So there's no problem there whatsoever to do it. The big problem is, of course, to do it in space. So you can't actually, if something goes wrong, you can't go there and change something, because the idea is that LISA will be in an orbit around the Sun, sort of trailing the Earth about 20 degrees angle between the Earth and LISA. So this is a huge distance. The other thing is that over the 5 million kilometers, if you send a laser, if you have a laser pointer, for instance, and you send a laser to the blackboard or the whiteboard, then you don't see very much happening. But if you would send a laser over 5 million kilometers, actually the beam of the laser widens enormously. So the spacecraft at the other side only sees a tiny fraction of the light that's emitted. So this is a problem, that you actually have to have relatively large telescopes. I mean, not large in terms of if you look at telescopes on Earth, but something like 40 or 50 centimeters or a meter, in order to detect simply the laser beam of the other spacecraft. So, and that makes it quite difficult.
So for interferometry, you need two laser bundles. So then at one point you look at the phase difference between those bundles. So what does LISA exactly look like then? Do you have two stations, do you have three stations, and what kind of laser beams do you use in LISA?
So there's a three satellite instrument, and beams will go all the way around, so from A to B, B to A, but also from A to C, C to A, and B to C, etc. So in that way, basically, different combinations of light can be made. And the good thing here is that actually the light is not really combined to get the interferometry as is done in optical or radio interferometry, but really the phase of the light is recorded so that you can sort of add and subtract all the combinations later on down on Earth in your analysis.
When a gravitational wave passes through these laser beams, you can see the phase difference and you can detect a gravitational wave. Can you also determine where the gravitational wave came from? What kind of resolution does LISA give us?
Yeah, so as soon as you see a wave, you cannot really tell where it comes from. The good thing why still we can actually pinpoint sources with LISA is that this detector is in an orbit around the Sun and is trailing the Earth. So if the source is on long enough, then actually the changing position of LISA, but also the changing orientation, because it's like a triangle, but it's slowly rotating in space. And actually the sensitivity of the instrument is different if a wave comes perpendicular to the plane of the triangle or in the same plane. So then over a year or part of a year already, they can actually work out where the source comes from. And of course it's a combination of how long you can see the source and how bright it is, or how strong the signal is, how well the position can be determined. But typically about a degree, sort of a little bit bigger than the area of the moon, is something that is quite feasible, and sometimes even smaller. So, and the good thing is that if you want then to look at the same area in the sky with optical telescopes or X-ray or radio, then these sizes are still quite large, but you can imagine that you can actually find the gravitational wave source with electromagnetic radiation, if there is any.
So LISA will be set in space. Does that limit the lifetime of the experiment?
Yes. Although it's not like some other space experiments where there's actually something that is slowly going away, like liquid nitrogen or something. In space, everything at some point breaks, and this means there is a limited lifetime. So this also makes it very complicated. Because it's an interferometer, if one of the satellites would fail, you would immediately have a problem. So that's one of the reasons why actually LISA will be quite an expensive mission, because there have to be a lot of sort of backup systems, etc., to make sure that not too soon the thing will fail. Plans are that it should be operational for nominal 3 years or 5 years, but people expect that actually up to 10 years would be quite feasible.
Do we know for sure that gravitational waves exist?
Well, that depends what you call for sure. We have very good evidence that they exist, and the reason is that there's a number of actually binary pulsars. So there's radio pulsars that are very compact objects in binaries, and the orbits of these binaries change slowly, and this has been measured with using the radio telescopes. So we know how the orbits change. And this exactly is the way that Einstein predicts that they should change, by sending out gravitational waves. But of course it means we haven't actually detected the gravitational wave. So you could imagine that there is an alternative theory that in some way exactly predicts the same change in the orbit, but not emitting gravitational waves, or at least not in the same way, or something like that. So we're not completely sure.
So you mentioned there are ground-based gravitational wave detectors. So they've never detected gravitational waves?
Well, yeah, so there are ground-based detectors, but they're actually only just operational. They started maybe a year ago or something like that. And there, as I said before, the technical challenge is maybe even worse than for the space-based missions. So 15 years ago or 20 years ago almost that these projects were planned. So one of the projects is a U.S. project called LIGO. There's a European, French, Italian project called Virgo and a German project called GEO. When they were planned 20 years ago, I think a lot of people said these guys are crazy. There's no way they can do it because you have to measure to such incredible accuracy. And it means basically that you have to isolate your instrument from all the background noises from cars driving by, etc., etc. But people have in the last 2 years or so reached the sensitivity that they predicted they would reach 20 years ago. And this is extremely impressive that they managed to do that. There's all these stories coming around that they have weird signals that they don't understand. And then in Germany, where the thing is close to Hamburg, it turns out these are measurements of the waves breaking on the shore of northern Germany. Or they had in the US, they had things that they couldn't really see what happened. And it turned out that people were logging hundreds and hundreds of miles away in Canada, and the trees falling down would actually give such a signal that you would see it in the detectors. I mean, this is the level of things happening.
So the ground-based detectors have never seen a gravitational wave, but they do have the sensitivity. Do we expect them to observe a gravitational wave anytime soon?
We are not completely sure. So the sad thing for the people building these ground-based detectors is that people always thought that there would be signals at the sensitivity level that they have now, but over the last 20 years we have learned more about the universe, and we now think that actually this type of signals that they are looking for, which I'll explain in a second what they are actually more rare than we thought. So actually they might have to wait for a year, or they might actually have to upgrade their instruments, which they are doing at the moment, in order to get the first real detections. So that actually brings me to the difference between ground-based and space-based. And one of the weird things of gravitational waves, different from electromagnetic waves, in electromagnetic waves, at least in relatively short wavelengths, typically the wavelength of the light is determined by the temperature of the object. And then, for instance, if you look at radio, you get what we call non-thermal emission, where the wavelength is determined by all kinds of other things. But in none of these cases is the wavelength actually related to the size of the object. And that's exactly what happens in gravitational waves. So the wavelengths of these gravitational waves is directly related to the size of the object. So big objects make big waves, and big waves have low frequencies, and small objects have small waves and have high frequencies. And in order to actually measure the waves, your instrument has to be at least not an awful lot smaller than the waves you try to measure, because then it becomes very difficult. So the very big objects can never be measured with instruments on Earth, because Earth is not very big, although you might think differently, but in terms of the universe, it's not very big. So the type of objects that can be measured from Earth are very small objects, like neutron stars, which only have a diameter of something like 10 kilometers. So that's close to this 5 kilometers. So that's why, so these ground-based detectors, they are sensitive to neutron stars, and then you have to have two, and together they have to be of the size of kilometers, so you can only see them at the moment that actually two neutron stars sort of collide. And this, in a binary, they get closer and closer, and we call that merging. So merging neutron stars are the type of sources that the ground-based detectors see. In space, if you have 5 million kilometers, you can see objects that are millions of kilometers. And that means that small stars, like we have white dwarfs, and that's my area of expertise, they are the size of the Earth, of the whole Earth, they can be observed, but also very massive black holes, because black holes are also very small, but if you make them very massive, they still become big. So very big black holes, and then you have to think of black holes maybe 100,000 or a million times more massive than our sun. So this is really serious stuff.
So you're talking about the Schwarzschild radius of the black hole then?
That's right, yes. So basically it's the size of the separation between the two objects in a binary if we simplify life a little bit.
You've done research in this as well. You've looked at foreground objects that Lisa can observe. You've already said a little bit what kind of objects there are. Can you tell us about what the sky would look like for Lisa? Would you be able to give us an impression of that?
Yeah, so actually that's that's why we want to go into space, because contrary to on Earth, we know for sure that as soon as there is an instrument in space, it will see gravitational waves. It might be, of course, that the Earth-based detectors, which are further ahead technologically, might detect them first, but it's not really a race. I mean, we're trying to understand the universe. But we know for sure there are sources. So there are basically three main categories of sources. And to start with the most modest is we know a number of white dwarf binaries. So you take two white dwarfs in a very compact binary that they're almost touching, so to say. And then you have to imagine something like the Earth-Moon system, but instead of the Earth and the Moon, you have two white dwarfs that are much more massive, and because of the Kepler laws, that means they go around each other more quickly because they have the same distance, so they would go around each other maybe in 10 minutes or 5 minutes or 20 minutes, and these are gravitational wave sources that Lisa will see. And we know a handful of these sources from electromagnetic observations. We have inferred that there's maybe several million of these we think 100 million of these in the galaxy, and Lisa will see plenty of these sources. The other thing Lisa will see is objects that have to do with supermassive black holes. And the closest supermassive black hole we know is in the center of our galaxy. There's a 4 million solar mass black hole. And the first thing that you could imagine is if you have a small object, like a white dwarf or a neutron star or a black hole, that is actually sort of falling in that a supermassive black hole. That also will give gravitational radiation that Lisa will see. And then finally, there are galaxies far, far away, and often they merge, so the two galaxies actually collide, and then we believe that the two black holes in the centers of these galaxies, if they both have one, would also merge. And these would be the ultimate Lisa sources, because there is an enormous amount of energy that becomes available when these black holes merge. This is the brightest or the most energetic event in the universe ever, and they would be seen basically all the way through the whole universe.
And this will allow us to see the universe in a way that we've never seen it before and study all kinds of new physics then?
That's certainly right, yes. So there's a number of things. One of the things is that in the last 20 years, I guess, we have developed that we think that all the structure in the universe, so the galaxies, etc., have formed from basically smashing together small bits into larger bits. And we also have found that many of the galaxies, even relatively small galaxies, have a black hole in their center. It's unclear how they get there, but anyway, they are there. So we actually think that, and this is called hierarchical structure formation, that in a way small bits are merged together to larger bits, and Lisa will, in the only direct way, actually see whether this is true. So that's a new astrophysics side. The other thing is that actually in the merger process of these two black holes, there were all kind of interesting things happening that are predicted by general relativity, and this is the type of sort of the limit of general relativity, where we know that things happen that normally don't happen in the stuff we can see. So we can actually test general relativity to limits that, well, way and way beyond we know now.
So Lisa sounds like a fantastic experiment. Is there any time scale at which Lisa will actually be launched? At what stage are we at the moment?
So there is a time scale, which is 2018, but we have to be a bit realistic. I mean, the time scale used to be 2010, which it clearly is not going to be. The problem is that it's technologically quite challenging, it's expensive, so it's actually a project that's joined between the European Space Agency, ESA, and the Americans in NASA. So this has advantages and disadvantages, and one of them is that it's actually complicated to get everybody thinking exactly along the same lines. And, well, money is hard to find. I mean, there are many other very interesting space projects that are also very expensive, so it's really a matter of setting priorities.
So let's talk about something else. I understand that some time ago you were involved in tracking whale sharks. How did that come about?
Well, involved is not really the right word. It is a very interesting story because it actually has some relation to LISA, because I was at a conference related to LISA sources and I had to tell about my white dwarfs and why it's interesting that LISA sees these. And I there met a guy I knew before. He's actually a radio astronomer, and he invited me to come with him to the pub and to have a beer with some friends of his. And then it turned out that one of them was thinking about a problem, because they were trying to sort of follow and to make an inventory of these whale sharks, which are big fishes that are maybe endangered, but it was always difficult to see, because you sometimes saw them but you never knew which it was because they didn't wear name tags. So then they took pictures and they have this distinct pattern of spots, white spots on a darker background. And it turned out that actually the way they were doing this was just taking these photographs and putting them on the ground and then trying to say, oh, that looks like that one and that looks like that one. So we talked about that, and I said, well, you know, this sounds quite a bit like the problem astronomers have. If you take a picture of the sky, you have a dark background with light spots, and you often want to know which star is which. So you have to compare it to another image of the sky. And actually, people have learned that this is a nightmare to do by hand, which these guys were experiencing themselves as well. So they wrote software. And the software basically is well, it's not very simple, but you can imagine what you do is you take every time you take the nearest neighbors of one spot, and you make triangles, and these triangles have a certain shape, and then you can actually compare all the triangles, and in that way you can find the best match of two images. So this is something they could use. And so that was that, and we had a very nice evening. And then a few years later, actually, I found out that they had taken this quite seriously, and they had developed this. And one of the problems is that these whale sharks, they are living creatures, and they are 3D. So actually, if you take an image, it's not always exactly the same, because the projection is different, and actually, due to muscles and stuff, the relative positions of the spots might change a little bit. So they actually did a lot of work to implement this, and actually, the astronomer... radio astronomer guy was very involved in doing that, and they apparently now use this to track these objects, or to actually basically recognize the whale sharks. So
that's a very nice application. So you can actually now track whale sharks. When people take pictures of them, they can match it with other whale sharks, and they can track them all over the world then.
Yeah, so the idea is now that so there's a project led by, I think he's Australian, actually, I don't think I ever met that guy who's leading this, and they have a database and you can send in pictures, and then they can basically use this technique to match the pictures to their database and say, oh, this picture must be Joe or must be Fred, or I don't know what they call them.
That's much better than giving them name tags, I imagine.
Yeah, I think so too. They're beautiful animals.
Well, thank you very much for this interview, guys.
No problem. Thank you very much.